Welcome to Alpha Unleashed with your host, Nadine Hatzidolios-McGill. In this series, Nadine will teach you how to tap into your alpha zone, harness its power, increase your self-esteem, and live a powerful, confident life. And now, here is your host, Nadine Hatzidolios-McGill.
Welcome to the podcast series, Alpha Unleashed. I am your host, Nadine Hatzidolios-McGill, self-esteem expert and seminar leader. On today's inaugural episode of Alpha Unleashed, we're talking about creating alpha pathways. And I have the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Holly Bardetz, brain researcher at the University of Regina. Hello, Dr. Bardetz.
Hello, hello, Nadine.
Thank you for being here today.
It is a pleasure to be here.
Thanks. Can you tell us what drew you to brain research in the first place?
That goes back a long time ago. I was originally in pre-vet medicine, and I hurt my knee, and I had to quit school for a little while. So then I had to get a series of jobs because I put myself through school. And one of the jobs that I got was to babysit a little boy. So a normally developing little boy was 13 months old, and he was learning language. At the same time, my own father had a brain tumor, and he was losing language in the same pattern that the little boy was learning language. So my dad would refer to me as his niece, not his daughter, and the little boy would call a knife a fork. So it's the same kind of patterns, and that is how I got very interested in the brain and how must the brain organize language and categorize language. So that's how it all started.
Right, good. I remember you telling that years ago. Holly and I are old friends. I'm not going to tell you how long. You'll figure out how old we are. So if I call her Dr. Holly, that's why. She's very familiar to me. So on this first episode of Alpha Unleashed, I want to provide research-based information that will set a foundation for understanding that reaching an Alpha Unleashed magnitude of self-esteem is, to a large degree, a scientific process. And your area of expertise is neurogenesis and neuroplasticity. Can you explain those two terms a little bit?
Neurogenesis means the brain can make new brain cells. So if you look at the word neurogenesis and you break it down, neuro refers to brain and genesis refers to a new beginning, like the first book in the Bible is Genesis. So brain and new beginning is the term that scientists use to talk about the brain making new brain cells. And then neuroplasticity is the ability of the brain to rewire itself. So again, you take that neuro for brain or neurons, and plasticity meaning malleable and can change. So neuroplasticity means your brain can and does rewire itself constantly all through your life.
Okay, that means you can teach an old dog new tricks.
For sure. And even people in nursing homes, some of the research was looking at their brains. And even if you are in your 90s or even 100, your brain is still changing. And it changes all the time according to the input that you give it.
Oh, excellent. Okay, so anybody out there that's over the age of 40, have no worries. Life goes on. Okay, so in your article, Our Brains and Self-Esteem, which was featured in Refined, which is a lifestyle magazine in Saskatchewan, you spoke about three steps to self-esteem. Can you outline those for us so that we can relate what you're talking about in neurogenesis and neuroplasticity to building self-esteem?
The brain is always changing, as I mentioned. It's changing whether you like it or not, according to the thoughts that you think and the experiences that you're having. So to help to make your brain, I always say you make your brain and then your brain makes you. So in order to change the pathways the way you want it to go to help you build self-esteem, there's three steps. And the first step is to just be aware of the thoughts that you say to yourself. We're always talking to ourselves. So the first step is maybe for the next few days, just pay attention to what you're actually saying. So if something happens, like sometimes I tend to run a little late and I can be down on myself and say, Holly, you're late again. You're such an idiot. So the first step is just to catch what you do say to yourself. And then the second step is to stop when you catch yourself saying something negative and say something positive. So yes, I'm running late again, but I really am good at driving, or I'm running late because I care about people so much. And so maybe I shouldn't have talked to the neighbor, but you just focus on what is good about you. And then the third step is to reinforce the positive thoughts. So maybe I'm late this morning because I was talking to my neighbor too much. This might even be a true story. And then I could say, well, I really do care about people. And actually that's a gift, and that's real. And so you just focus on what you do well. And this is a term called self-directed neuroplasticity, meaning you're using neuroplasticity to your own benefit. You're directing your own thoughts. And so you are physically changing your brain and making new pathways. And if you keep doing this over and over, then you're going to develop new pathways and more likely to go that way just out of habit.
Okay, so when you spoke at my seminar in Calgary in 2017, you used some visuals to help the people in that room understand building pathways in the brain. And what I'd like you to do is use one or two of those visuals that you used then, and as imaginatively as you can, describe building those pathways for our listeners.
Okay. I remember when I did that. And one of the ways that I described it is to imagine a field. I'm from Saskatchewan and you're from Alberta. So we have prairie fields. So imagine in the fall when the wheat is really high and you have to walk through the wheat. When there's no pathways at all, it's a little bit harder. But if you walk through one pathway and then come back that way, you're going to start to build a certain pathway that you're just naturally going to go through. And that if you had a couple people going with you, let's say you were going to go through that pathway to your neighbor's house. So you did that a few times and your neighbor did that a few times. And then maybe your little kids did that a few times. Grandparents were doing that. So you can just imagine over time that pathway is set. But if you only went through it once, then after a while with the wind and the rain and just nature, that pathway would, those wheats would come up, and then you wouldn't be able to see that pathway anymore. So I use that imagery to help people understand that you can actually make a pathway in your brain, and you can change it as well. If you normally go one way to your neighbor's house through the prairie field, you can start another path. And just by going back and forth and back and forth, you're going to make that path the path that people go through. Or in your brain, you're going to make that path the path that your thoughts will normally just go down. And the other one the other path that you made in the wheat field will actually come up again and you won't even see it. So same way in your brain, you'll want to form pathways that are most beneficial to you. And let me remember, what was the other one? Oh yes, I remember. It was pipe cleaners. When I gave a seminar in Calgary, I brought some pipe cleaners and I gave everyone pipe cleaners. And I said, I want you to put your pipe cleaners together in some way and maybe even join your pipe cleaner with your neighbor's pipe cleaner so that they were all together in one long path of pipe cleaners. But just like the brain, pipe cleaners don't have to stay that way. They can change. So let's say that your pipe cleaner is going to someone on your left and we say, oh, that's not helping us that much anymore. That's the negative self-talk. We want to change it. So you just unwind your pipe cleaner and put it to somebody else. And again, you're making a different pathway. And just like in your brain, you can learn and unlearn things to benefit yourself. And so in a year, you can actually have more self-esteem than you do today.
Well, that's good. I'm glad you mentioned a year, because it doesn't even have to be that long. But as long as we set ourselves a goal to reach, and putting a time to that keeps us accountable in using the strategies that you're giving us to then build those pathways and reach the esteem that we want to reach.
That's true. It doesn't take a year. The reason I said a year is because I also work with seniors, and I teach them about not just self-esteem, but partly self-esteem, but also just brain health. And I tell them that a year from now, your brain can be better than it is today. So that's why I said a year, because that's what I'm used to saying. But it can definitely happen sooner than that.
Well, that's good to know. An example for me, I think, is that I dance. I take dance classes and we have to learn choreography. And it doesn't necessarily get easier to learn it, but the confidence in learning it is what I find is helpful. My confidence increases every time I take a dance class. And so that is a pathway I'm building to help me learn the choreography in the class. Okay, so further along in your refined article, you talk about three influences that affect self-esteem. Please go into those now and tell us how they relate as well.
The first thing is what you tell yourself. You're the one who's in your head more than anybody else is in your head. And so it's what you tell yourself about what happens. Let's say you have a meeting at work and the person you're meeting with is somewhat rude and grumpy and not happy with what you brought to the meeting. And a natural way to leave that meeting would be like, oh, I didn't do a good job. I don't know what she's expecting, but I was a failure. I am a failure. My work isn't good enough. I'm just not good at this. But what I encourage people to do is to don't do that to yourself. You decide what that means. So if that person is grumpy, you can say, that person was kind of grumpy. I wonder what's going on in her life. And I wonder if I can help. I wonder if I could even get her a coffee card and say, hey, you seem to be, you don't want to antagonize her, but just say, maybe have a good day. And just so you put it on, maybe it wasn't you. Maybe it was her. Maybe she was up all night with a sick child. Maybe she's not feeling well. So it wasn't necessarily your fault. But a lot of people, and especially women, I find, and I'll explain that, we are hard on ourselves, and we often will take what happens and blame ourselves for something when really it might not have anything to do with us. And the reason I say women more than men is because I teach at university, I teach neurolinguistics, brain and language, and other classes as well, linguistics. And I've found there's a huge pattern between female students and male students. And female students will, if you ask a question in class, the female students in general will say, I'm not sure, but I think maybe, and they'll often give an answer like that. Whereas in general, there's always exceptions, but in general, the young men will say, oh, well, clearly it's da 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 da. And if you hear the men or anyone say it that confidently, you assume they're right, and they have to be right, and they know it all. But at the end of the course, I see all the marks and all the tests, and very often the guys aren't really the ones who really know it. So I tell my female students this, what I see over and over, and to have confidence in themselves, because they're probably right. Like, chances are they are right. So I try to teach them to say it more confidently. And then now back to the three things. The first one was, the question was, three influences that affect self-esteem. And the first one was what we tell ourselves about what happens to us. And the second influence is that we are social and we do better in a community. There's something really important about that, though. The community has to be positive. I encourage people to associate with positive people, people who are just upbeat themselves and tend to be positive themselves. And even more importantly, tend to be positive to you. So some people can not be really good friends and cut you down and criticize you, and I can't believe you're wearing that. Well, if you can, try not to associate with those kinds of people as much as you can. I mean, if it's family, you might have to see them at Christmas time. But in general, we can pick the people we hang around with. And I encourage you to hang around with people who are going to be positive themselves and be positive for you. And the third influence that affects self-esteem is physical exercise. The brain is, it's scientifically, there's a human spirit in there for sure, and I believe in that very much. But it's also chemicals and electricity. And chemicals are neurotransmitters, and when you exercise, you can encourage or you can cause the positive chemicals in your brain to make you feel good. So when you go for a run or dance, you have that runner's high. And those are physical changes in your brain that make you feel good. And there is no antidepressant as good as physical exercise to make your brain feel good about itself. So yeah, just exercise helps make you feel good about yourself and motivated and try new things. And then that spirals up as well.
Okay, so is there a type of exercise that's more effective, or any physical exercise will do?
Well, this is cutting edge research. Right now, we know for sure that aerobic exercise causes those endorphins or those feel-good endotransmitters in your brain. So we know for sure that aerobic exercise does that. And now we're looking at, what about lifting weights? What about dancing? What about different kinds of things? I suppose dancing would, because it's aerobic, so that's included in aerobic. So we're finding that the resistance weights and the stretching and all that does some good as well, but that's where the research is at right now. So if you really need to build yourself up, I would say go for the aerobic exercise. But check with me in a week and I'll let you know what the latest research is saying about the lifting weights for that as well. But I would also really encourage people, as far as exercise, is to do something they enjoy. So Nadine, I know you're a great dancer and I know you like to dance. So for you, it's dancing. Other people like to go for a run outside. I don't like that as much as putting on headphones, blasting some music, and going on the elliptical. So find something that you enjoy doing, because if you're doing something that you don't really enjoy, that's not going to help make you feel better. So yeah, that's about exercise.
Okay, so enjoyable is key as well as what you're doing. Okay, going back to the class that you talked about that you're teaching in Regina, I don't know if you want to describe that a little bit more, what your clientele is, how often you teach, or how long a course is for a person. But what I want you to talk about is results that you see for the individuals in regards to their self-esteem from the time that they join you to the completion of a class.
The class originally, I teach brain health and fitness to the general public. So it's based on the latest research, and I teach people what lifestyle factors they can do to make their brain healthier. And each class has an education component, it has a social component, and it has a fun activity, which is cognitively challenging. And with, as far as from when people come in from the beginning of class to the end of class, it's an 8-week series. People at the end feel very hopeful and they feel encouraged, and I would say they feel happier. At first, these classes were designed for seniors, so people over 65, and people had the feeling that their brains had to get worse and worse as they get older. So they have hope, because I tell them that your brain doesn't have to get worse and worse, and it really physically can and will be better if you do some very simple things. So, and also I think the social aspect is important, because sometimes people are really lonely and isolated. And so when they come here and people actually care that they're there, that can make a difference too. So from the beginning to the end, people have more hope and have more self-esteem. And interestingly enough, although it was designed for seniors, each class I'm finding younger and younger people coming. Last time I had some people in their 40s, quite a few in their 50s. The research is showing, actually this makes me happy, because the research shows that it's in middle age that you can make the biggest difference for your future brain. Just like we should put away money for our retirement, we can build extra brain cells and make more networks for our future brain retirement. This is called building cognitive reserve. So you're making more neurons, more connections, so that as you get older, you'll have more there to draw from.
Great. So you and I are still safe in our given age range.
We certainly are.
Okay. When you say cognitively challenging, can you give a specific exercise that you'll use? Like, what does that mean, cognitively challenging?
It means anything that is going to tell your brain that it has to keep thinking. So cognitively means thinking, and challenging means something that your brain has to stay almost alert for. For example, if a person is in a retirement home and all they do is sit in front of their TV in their own room their brain isn't going to be very challenged. But if you go out, if that same person goes out and does some of the social activities and reads and goes to a different movie, things like that, that will tell your brain that it needs to keep going, because just like any other muscle, use it or lose it. So the brain is so amazing. The human body is so amazing, but this is about the brain. So the brain is so amazing that if it decides that it doesn't need to keep learning, it's going to start pruning away, because the brain takes a lot of energy. And so the body will say, well, we don't need this much anymore, so let's start pruning this way and pruning that away. So you don't want that to happen. So you want to keep doing things so that your brain says, okay, we need to keep alert. We need to keep going. We need to keep strong. So that's what cognitively challenging means. And some examples, everyone thinks Sudoku and crossword puzzles, but that's not what I mean. It could be anything like brushing your teeth with your non-dominant hand, brushing your hair with your non-dominant hand, anything so you're not just doing the same old, driving, taking a different route, going to a movie that you probably wouldn't go to, but still hopefully you find it enjoyable, meeting new people, doing a yo-yo, playing with a yo-yo, playing with a ball on a paddle with a string, like anything at all like that. Even just sitting home and trying to draw a map of what your house looked like when you were a kid. So anything at all that's going to make your brain have to stay alert.
Okay, I want to speak to that a little bit, because my mom did crosswords all her life, every day. And she ended up getting dementia. And so it was evident to me as well that it wasn't just about crosswords or, like you say, the Sudoku. And she was very much an introvert and a private person. And do you know if there's research based on that personality, like introverts versus extroverts, or is it just simply what we do? Because I have an extrovert daughter who recently moved to Ireland, but right now she is very depressed because she didn't know anybody going, and she's isolated, and she can't go out because she's broke, and all of those things. So is there research on how that plays in? Like, socially, does that mean I can just go to the movie theater and I'm around people, or engaging with people?
Well, there's extroverts, as you mentioned, there's extroverts and introverts. And being socially connected does not mean you have to have 100 friends. If you are an introvert and you just want one or two closer, deeper friends, then that is fine for you. You have no interest in meeting 50 people. If you are an extrovert, you might be more likely to enjoy being with the 50 people. But loneliness and isolation doesn't just mean being with people, because I'm sure we've all had that experience where you feel lonely in a crowd. You're at a party, but you just feel horrible. So it's not just a matter of being with people. It's a matter of being socially connected. And they say that if you even have one person that if something went wrong, you could call on, that's good. You are socially connected. And some people can feel isolated in a nursing home with lots of people around them. Other people can feel isolated at work. So it really isn't the number of people. It's if you feel like you have a friend out there who really cares about you. And even if you care back, some people, they did some research where they put a plant in half the people's in the nursing home, half the rooms. And the people who had plants lived longer than the people who didn't have a plant. So it's feeling connected and you need somebody. But it's also reaching out. So if you have a reason to care for somebody, you can be in that same nursing home and think, oh, no one comes to visit me. But if you think, well, I'm here, I better take care of Miss Little Lily down the hall because no one visits her. So you can do things like that, just so you feel like you have a purpose and someone cares about you, or you care about someone else.
As long as I've known you, you have been an extremely positive person, probably the most positive person that I know. And you're able to turn every situation, regardless how terrible it is, into something good. You find the silver lining. Do you think that is something that was taught to you, or is that just your personality? And have you tied that into the way that you teach now this subject?
I think I've always been like that. So, and first of all, I never would have considered that. Like, I would never have described myself like that, but I guess I am. And if something happens, I know that I consciously do say, like, say someone cut me off in traffic, instead of saying, "Oh, what a jerk," I actually will say, "Oh my goodness, they probably have a nut allergy and they have to get to the hospital." So I might give them more room. Or if my neighbor, this actually just happened, I was walking my dog and she saw me and walked the other way. So you could think, well, she hates dogs, hates me, whatever. But I think, ah, she's probably having a hard time. Maybe her husband wasn't very nice to her last night. So I don't know. I guess I was just always like that. But I know in the research, resilience, resilient kids, resilient people, they are the ones who take what happens and make the best of it. So I've been like that. As you say, I guess I have. And again, I would never describe myself like that, but thank you. And the resilient people who are resilient do that, and they can be taught to do that. So there's something in the research about that as well. And I suppose, again, you're building pathways in your brain, a habitual way of thinking, and then you're just more likely to go like that in the future.
Okay, so I'm sitting here very thankful, because that is the reason I hang out with you. You are such a positive person. And I tend to be the opposite. And I know over the last few years, I really concentrated on unlearning pathways and rebuilding new pathways. And there's hope for me for my road rage, because I can get over it and I can change and think the way that you think when I'm angry in the car at the person that just cut me off or whatever. So we have a couple minutes left. Is there anything in particular that you really like to leave with our listeners? Something you'd like to reinforce?
I just like to reinforce that the brain, we live in our brains. Of course, I believe that we are spirits and we are human as well, but the brain can naturally take its own path for what you set it up to take. And you have to be aware of that. So it can be your best friend, but it can be your worst enemy. So you have to just be aware of how your brain is working. And I guess the most important thing I'd like to say is you do make your brain, because you can choose your thoughts, and that's self-directed neuroplasticity, the scientific word for it. But you can create the paths that you're naturally going to go down. And before you know it, it's a habit. And so you make your brain, and then your brain makes you. That's what I'd like to leave everybody with.
Thank you. That is an extremely powerful statement. Good choice to leave us with. And before we go, I would like to take this opportunity to congratulate on two other accomplishments of yours. One was winning the 2018 Women of Distinction Award in the category of education and mentorship. And the other was the recent release of your book, Women, Exercise, and Neurological Changes. And it is about positive effects of exercise and the brain in women. And I believe specifically over the age of 65 for that study, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, great. So thank you again, Holly, for taking the time out of your busy schedule. As Holly said, there's cutting edge research going on as we speak. She mentioned connecting with her next week to find out what results she's coming up with now. And thank you, listeners, for being in on our inaugural episode of Alpha Unleashed. In our next episode, I am going to be reviewing what Holly has talked about and giving you some more examples and exercises to practice daily. But for now, it's time to unleash your alpha. It's time to unleash your soul. Thank you so much.
Now that Nadine has shared some tools to help you tap into your alpha zone and increase your self-esteem, it's time for you to take charge and live a powerful, confident life. If what Nadine has spoken about today resonated with you and you would like to explore more, Nadine invites you to schedule an appointment with her via her website at www.hatsoff.ca, spelled HATZOFF.ca. Thank you for listening. For more episodes, please visit the Tenacious Living Network at TLRStation.com.